Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I was just saying to the lecturer what a good turnout there was yesterday, and he said, but what will it be like today? Well, I think I can say that today it is just as good as it was yesterday, if not better. Reputation spreads, and by the time of the third lecture, I'm sure we'll be turning people away. Indeed, it was with great difficulty that I persuaded the security guard to admit the lecturer. He didn't have his credentials on him, but I said, you ought to know who this is, Professor Richard Layard. And I have known Richard for many years, and our first real sort of enterprise together was in the times of Mrs. Thatcher, when we put our heads together and we started up a think tank called the Employment Institute, which later became the Employment Policy Institute. And I think we were then both convinced that happiness had got something to do with employment, and the Thatcher era did create a certain amount of unhappiness in that direction with the rise in unemployment, and that I hope is one of the things which will come into today's lecture, which is concerned with income and happiness and rethinking economic policy. So clearly, although we've done some rethinking since Mrs. Thatcher, there's a good deal more rethinking which Richard is going to give us, and I have pleasure in welcoming him again to the podium.
Thank you very much, Christopher. Actually, employment is tomorrow, but today today is income. Yesterday, we saw that despite the huge increases in income in advanced countries, there has been no rise in happiness. What I want to do today is to try and explain that and to draw some policy conclusions. But first, as a researcher, I should begin with a caution. I hope you can read it. Researchers say I'm not happier for being richer, but do you know how much researchers make? Well, in one sense, the golfer is onto something. For actually, there are two key facts about the relation between income and happiness. At any one time, in any one country, rich people are on average happier than poorer ones. So the golfer was right in that sense. But over time, advanced societies have not grown happier as they've grown richer. So in that sense, the researcher was right. And we can see the combination of these two facts in this table. There you can see that if you start with 1975, as we did yesterday, in fact, you can see that the rich people in the top quarter of income are on balance happier than the poor people in the bottom quarter of income. But the depressing thing is that if you move on from 75 to 98, when the rich had become very much richer, they were still no happier, and the poor likewise were as unhappy as they had been before. So that is the challenge, how to understand that the rich are happier than the poor, but as we all get richer, we don't get happier. And this same pattern, which I've given you in this case for the United States, two different points in time, you could also find if you compared two countries at the same date. So what, in fact, is going on? Well, obviously people must be comparing their income with some norm, with some level of expectations, and that norm must be moving up, and it must be moving up in line with actual income. And you can see that that's so from the following data collected by the Gallup poll in the US for very many years. The question they asked is, what is the smallest amount of money a family of four needs to get along in this community? And the required income is this dotted line, and you can see that it basically just follows along behind the actual average incomes which people are getting. Here's another even more depressing fact. Since 1972, Americans have been asked whether they are satisfied with their financial position. Are you satisfied with your financial position? Well, surely as people get richer, you'd think they would be a bit more satisfied and feel a bit easier. But although real income per head rose by 50% since the series began, the proportion of people who say they're pretty well satisfied with their financial situation has what? Fallen. So it's this moving up of the norm, and where's it coming from? I believe it's coming from two sources, habituation and rivalry. First, people compare what they have with what they've become used to, that's habituation. And second, they compare what they have with what other people have, and that's the process of a rivalry. And through habit, what is going on is I get used to a standard of living, and that reduces the enjoyment which I would get from any particular future standard of living, the higher the standard I've been used to. Similarly with rivalry, if others get better off, I need more income in order to feel as good as I did before. So the two mechanisms which help to explain why all our efforts to become richer are so largely self-defeating in terms of the overall outcome for society. What I want to do, first half of the talk, is to discuss these effects in turn and then come on to the policy implications. So let's begin with habit, or psychologists call it adaptation. A key feature of any successful organism is its ability to adapt to its environment. And human beings are amazingly adaptable. And of course, this is both a strength and a weakness. In the face of adversity, it saves us from abject misery, but it also makes it difficult to lift us onto a permanently higher plane. So on the downside, for example, people who become paraplegic suffer greatly immediately after their stroke, but after a while their measured happiness is only somewhat below the average in the population. And on the upside, the thing works in the opposite way. When people get married, their happiness soars, but within 2 years it's roughly where it was. So when our living standards increase, we first move on to a high, but then we get used to it, and it makes little difference to us, but we would find it very difficult to go back to the one which we had before. I personally remember opposing the introduction of central heating into our flat, but it was done, and I can't imagine living without it. The evidence, there's lots of good psychological evidence of this process of habituation. And one approach is to compare people with different incomes. And you ask each individual, what after-tax income for your family would you consider to be very bad, bad, insufficient, sufficient, good, very good? And from those answers, you can pick out for each individual the income level which is between sufficient and insufficient, in the middle of what he thinks is needed. And this required income, of course, not surprisingly, varies strongly with the actual income of the person who's answering the question. And typically, a 10% rise across people in their income causes a roughly 5% rise in the income which they say is required. So you can see there's just enough margin to make the richer person happier. But there's a lot of movement in the norm that's required. Alternatively, we can look at reported happiness over time. In panel studies of individuals in the UK, job satisfaction is unaffected by the level of wages, and in fact is found to depend only on their rate of change, which implies a very strong negative effect of habit coming from the previous wage. At a more aggregate level, taking a time series of European countries, two colleagues and I found that lagged income reduced average happiness by two-thirds as much as current income increased it. So, again, you could get ahead of the game a little bit, but you were constantly being chased by the rising norm. The fact that you get ahead of the game means, of course, that in this particular study, the rise in income did increase happiness somewhat. But in the historical record, there were other things going on that offset that, higher divorce, higher crime, and so on. So, what we're seeing is people measuring their situation, importantly by reference to where they've recently got to. And psychologists call this the hedonic treadmill. You can see the little rat at work. He tries to rise up a rung, but in the next period, that rung is down at the bottom again, keeps on trying to rise, and he's running in order to stand in the same place. And one way of thinking of this is as a problem of addiction, where people's past standard of living is affecting in a negative way the happiness which they can get from their present living standard. So that's just what alcoholic addiction is, it's just what smoking addiction is, that to get a given satisfaction you need more than you did before. Now, of course, if addiction was a completely general feature of human life, so that you just got used to everything, it'd be awfully difficult to make yourself feel any better. But there may be some things which you're less likely to get used to than others. And if so, it's very important to know which are the things which pull and which are the things which give enduring happiness. And Robert Frank, who's written a wonderful book on this, he's argued strongly that the things that we get used to most easily and then take for granted are material things, cars and houses, and that we don't have the same appalling experience with the rest of our life, time we spend with our family, or the quality of our work, or the security of our work, other less material things. Now, there's another aspect to this in thinking about whether something is going wrong or not, and that is, do we foresee the process of addiction? Because the problem will arise mainly if we don't foresee it, because then we might make the wrong choices. So if we don't foresee how we get used to our material possessions, then of course we will overinvest in acquiring them, and that's a costly thing. To buy them, we'll have to be giving up time with our family and friends. And there's lots of evidence that people underestimate the process of habituation. One example near home is that it's been found that academics overestimate the happiness effects of gaining tenure. And the result of any of these forms of addiction which require effort in order to get something which then pulls is that you're distorting your life away from other pursuits, leisure, etc., towards self-defeating work. And I do want to stress that in these questions which look a bit as if they're distortions between the present and future, actually the main distortion is between work and leisure, rather than between spending money today and saving, and I can supply a paper that demonstrates this. Now, if you've got a distortion of this kind, like the distortion through addiction to cigarettes, the classic way to offset it, of course, is to tax it, and that will discourage excessive indulgence in it. I just park that for a moment, and I'm now going to come on to the question of rivalry, which is the second factor explaining the paradox of income and happiness. And I want to begin with a simple question. Let me ask you which of these two worlds you would prefer to live in, assuming that the prices were the same. In the first world, you get $50,000, but others get half that. And in the second world, you get $100,000, but others get more than double that. Well, I don't think I can ask. See, I don't see any hands go up. Don't think I can ask such a distinguished body to vote on a question like this. But graduate students of public health at Harvard were asked to do just that. Actually, they were asked to do a proper questionnaire response. You can perhaps guess what they chose. The majority preferred the top world, the world where they were not so well off, but their relative position was better. And there have been many, many other studies that have shown how strongly people care about other people's incomes as well as their own. You may not think it needs proving, but I can tell you that if you mention these points to many of my colleagues, they become quite apoplectic at the thought that the benefits which they derive from their income could be affected by the incomes which others obtain. And yet, we all know that we can easily get upset if other people get a raise and we don't, that we don't feel anything like so bad if the changes are the same for everybody, and in fact we sometimes might even accept a pay cut if other people were doing the same. Essentially, that was what happened in the Second World War, and there was remarkably little economic discontent because the sacrifice was shared. By contrast, the great inflation of the 1970s caused enormous discontent, although real incomes, average real incomes were rising, because what was going on through most of the year was that the last raise you got was being overtaken by other people. So 364 days a year, your relative wages were falling and rising on only one day a year. These are the real stuff of discontent and content. Now, who do people compare themselves with? Mainly with people close to themselves. And what matters is what happens to your reference group, because your reference group symbolizes something that might have happened to you. So much of the most intense rivalry is within organizations, within families even. And in organizations, as we know, calm can often only be maintained by keeping people's salaries secret. There's a recent law coming out that's going to prevent this, and we may see a great deal of unhappiness caused by the new law. In families, it's been found that the more your spouse earns, the less satisfied you are with your own job. And among women, it's been found that if your sister's husband is earning more than your own husband, you are more likely to go out to work yourself. This is the subtle way these things work. People are very concerned about their relative income and not about its absolute level only. They want to keep up with the Joneses and, if possible, to outdo them. Now, of course, one of the problems may be that people change their reference groups, and I'll be coming on to that later as a historical fact. But let me just give you two examples where people became objectively better off but felt subjectively worse. One is the case of East Germany, where the living standards of people in work, at least, have soared in the last 10 years, but the recorded level of happiness has plummeted. Why? Because they compare themselves now with the West Germans, whereas previously they compared themselves with the Russians. Another case is the position of women, whose pay and opportunities have improved considerably relative to men, but their level of happiness has not. And in fact, in the US, women's happiness has fallen relative to men's, perhaps because they now compare themselves more specifically with men than they used to and are more aware of the gaps that still exist. So, given rivalry, the finding of our tables are not very surprising. The reason the rich are happier than the poor is that from right up at the top, they're more likely to be comparing themselves with people below them, and people at the bottom are more likely to be comparing themselves with people a bit above them. But for a society as a whole, of course, the implications of this finding are massive. And I want to start just by imagining the most extreme case where people cared only about their relative income and not about their absolute income at all. It would then follow, of course, that economic growth couldn't make people better off unless they progressively adopted reference groups that were lower and lower down in the relative distribution. But if the reference groups remained unchanged and everybody's income was going up, nobody would feel any happier. However, that's an extreme case. The evidence suggests that things are not quite as bad as that, and I'm trying to move to quantification because this is going to bear on my tax proposal. If you compare states in the USA, you find that if other people in your state get more, you feel worse off, as I've been saying. But the negative feeling is not so large that it completely cancels the gain if your income rises as much as everybody else's. So there's hope after all, and to be precise, if my income increases, the loss of happiness to everybody else is about 30% of the gain in happiness to me. So that 30% is an important number. It's a form of pollution. It's the fraction of the potential gain in happiness which is lost because of the negative effect on other people. And of course, if you have pollution, the standard way to discourage it is to tax the polluter. So if my numbers are right, the polluter should lose 30 pence out of every pence that he earns, a tax rate on additional income of 30% at the margin. And the result of this would be, assuming that the tax proceeds come back to society through something which they consider useful, everybody will work less hard, and the self-defeating element in work will have been eliminated. They'll only work for things to the extent that they value them for themselves. But for this conclusion to be correct, some of you may have noticed one further condition is necessary. It must be the case that people are comparing their income with that of other people, but they're not comparing their leisure. So, of course, the Harvard students were asked another question. Next question. If you have 2 weeks vacation and others have half, how does that compare with if you have 4 weeks vacation but others have double? And in this case, very sensibly, the Harvard students opted for D. So they're not comparing their leisure with other people's, even though they were comparing their income with other people's. And it's the fact that it's the income that is the focus of rivalry, which means that we are in danger of devoting too much of our potential leisure to generating income, which in the end makes none of us feel better off. So I'm proposing a tax, and I did this in America first, and I was amazed the number of libertarians there were. This is at Princeton, which is a civilized place. Libertarians sprung up all over the place, and they said, but you're penalizing me because this guy has got this horrible rivalrous sentiment in him. So I said, well, what about you? Don't you have any rivalrous sentiment in you? He said, well, if I do, I don't mind being, I don't mind suffering from it. I don't want anyone to protect me from my envious nature. But it seems to me this is silly. I mean, we have to be talking, economics are meant to be talking about human nature as it is. These phenomena of social comparisons are extremely deep in all of us. And it's silly to run a society as if this was not the case. And libertarians of all people are meant to start with human nature as it is. So what I want to do now is just to point to the need to really rethink fundamentally our theory of economic policy in the light of rivalry and habit. And we have in economics a subject that's called public economics, and a wonderful book written by Tony Atkinson and Joe Stieglitz, which sort of summarizes what everybody thinks about it. This subject was, in a sense, founded here at LSE by James Mead when he was here. It was carried on here by Amartya Sen and Tony Atkinson, and of course at Oxford and then Cambridge by James Merlies. It's a very British subject, though there are, of course, Americans like Joe Stieglitz and Marty Feldstein who contributed greatly to it. And the normal starting point of that theory is that taxation distorts the choice between leisure and income and makes people work too little. So then they say, but of course we need taxes in order to finance public expenditure or redistribute from the rich to the poor. But what the subject says is that when we compare the tax costs with the benefits from the spending, we should always allow for substantial excess burden of the tax over and above the money that's collected, because it's distorting the choices of those who are being taxed, or indeed those who are receiving income transfers, in a way that makes them work too little. So the presumption is always against taxation, unless you can really establish the case. When you do cost-benefit analysis, you always put in, for anything financed by public expenditure, if it costs £100, you put in 130 or something to allow for that distortion. And I participated actually in redrafting the Treasury Green Book, which has this number in it, only a few years back, but I'm now repenting of that. Because it's obvious that if you take bribery and habituation seriously, you don't believe that the situation that produces the optimum balance of work and leisure is the zero tax one. You believe that you need corrective taxes in order to have an efficient balance between work and leisure. And so long as the level of tax is not higher than the efficient corrective level, cost-benefit analysis of public expenditure should be done without adding any extra for the excess burden of publicly financed expenditure. So what is the appropriate level of taxation at the margin? Well, obviously we are just at the very beginning of studying these issues. I already suggested 30% to deal with rivalry, and I would have thought the even weaker evidence we have on habit would suggest at least that much. The study I quoted suggested more. So it seems to me that we shouldn't think that the kinds of levels of taxation we have at the margin, in Britain it's roughly 50% now if you include taxes on expenditure. Europe it's perhaps more like 60 in typical European country. We shouldn't think that these are distorting levels of taxation. They're probably appropriate levels for controlling the rat race and the inefficient self-defeating accumulation of goods whose benefits pall. So I think in a way, when you think about why the electorate is willing to vote for these taxes, I think it's true that it's normally said they're voting for them because they want the services which are paid for, though a lot of the money goes to redistribution as well. But I think they're also expressing a certain scepticism about the notion that the money you spend for yourself is the most wonderful thing in the world, and it always gives you more happiness than anything else that you could be getting. So the proposition that I'm wanting to put forward is that we stop apologizing for taxes. We just stop it, because there's very good reasons for taxes, quite apart from the fact that they finance public spending. And I would like to suggest that this becomes an additional argument in, dare I say it, the third way. Okay. Of course, what it means is that we accept taxes which reduce the GDP, because we don't think the GDP is the god. We think the GDP would be too high if everybody worked as hard as they would in the absence of taxes. But that is not the going to deter us from having these efficient, I repeat, efficient taxes. So that's the first main point I wanted to make. And incidentally, it's a typical economist's argument. it's an economist's argument in this sense. It takes the tastes as given, and it says, given this picture of human nature and tastes that we have, how can we arrive at the best possible allocation of our resources? But of course, as I said, tastes are not completely given, and the second issue which arises is, should we be trying to change our tastes to avoid this loss of happiness which we get from our envy? That's one question, and the other question which I want to discuss is whether in fact we're becoming more envious. So that's the basic theme of the rest of this lecture. Should we try to change our rivalrous attitudes, and are we in fact becoming more rivalrous? Well, obviously, a degree of rivalry is wired into the genes. Among our friends and relatives, the monkeys, the top male monkey gets the ladies, and in consequence, monkeys strive to reach the top. And those that do get to generate most of the babies, and so the drive to reach the top becomes spread through the gene pool in the monkey population. Now, it's not that they are wanting to reproduce so much, it's that they're simply wanting to be top. And this is the really unfortunate point from the point of view of moral reformers. We know that these monkeys are wanting to be top from the following fascinating fact, that if you look at serotonin, which is the neurotransmitter that accompanies good feeling in the brain, you can study how the level of serotonin varies in monkeys according to how top they are. This is the work of McGuire and their colleagues at UCLA. So they found that when a male monkey becomes top monkey, his serotonin zooms up. But then, being researchers, they can displace this monkey. And when he's displaced, his serotonin collapses. And he becomes very unhappy. So his happiness is coming from being top and not just getting the ladies. And some similar effects have been found in humans, but the most interesting fact is this is an astonishing fact, that if you take all the Oscars that have ever, well, all the Oscars and Oscar nominees that have ever been, and you differentiate between the ones who won the Oscars and the ones who didn't, which is a pretty random fact, it was found that the ones who won the Oscars live, how much longer? 4 years longer. That's a very long time. So the desire for position and status is pretty universal amongst humans. This was an important source of our reproductive fitness in the wild. But the issue obviously is that since our life has become easier, can we somehow downgrade this? Obviously, to an extent, we have changed our society. We've protected weaker people in the society who would never have survived in the wild. So what should we do about our competitive instinct? Well, I think questioning the competitive instinct is not the same as being a communist. We all know that life goes better when most people make most of their own arrangements for satisfying their needs, and the market system delivers good products and also more personal autonomy. But I think there still is a very serious issue about actions which are undertaken in pursuit of status and are truly fruitless. at the level of society, because the sum of status is fixed. It's a zero-sum game. And in case it's not obvious that this is a problem, I want to spell it out once more, because there are many people in this room, I'm sure, who've said we've got to incentivize people more, people have got to be made more competitive. Those of us who run things have surely done this many, many times. People will say, well, I don't mind. I don't mind what's inspiring the man who makes my car, provided he makes a proper car. If he's motivated by status, and that's self-defeating at the level of society, it doesn't bother me. I want a good car. So let's motivate him any way we can. And we hear it every day. And I do want to point out the total fallacy in this line of thought. It's one that many of us acquired when we read Samuelson. And the word that describes it is the theory of consumer sovereignty, which gives you the impression in a very simplified analysis that the only thing which is produced in society is the thing which is sold to the consumer. And it completely overlooks the fact that the person who buys the thing at the end is the same as the person who made it in aggregate. We are all consumers and we are all producers, and we're equally important as both. So, of course, there may be things which I consume for their own sake, and that is fine. But if I am also buying things as a route to status, the part of my effort as a producer which is going into buying those things is completely self-defeating at the level of society. And this is actually very serious. So I want to take you through some extremely simple, formal analysis. Okay, so here's the individual. And the individual's happiness is depending on his leisure and on the consumption that he really values, not conspicuous consumption, let's say, that gives him rank, but things he really likes. But the other thing he's after is rank. And he is going to be sacrificing his leisure in order to get his valued consumption and in order to get his rank. And that's the way he's going to do the best for him that he can for himself, taking everybody else's actions as given. But what's the outcome at the level of society? Well, if you add up the happiness of society, I'm just adding up the happiness of all the different individuals, that little thing here means the addition of the happiness of all the individuals. That, of course, is going to be the sum of, which has got left out, all these functions for all the individuals, plus the sum, alpha, times the sum of all the ranks. And what's the sum of all the ranks? Well, it's something which is the same all the time. I mean, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, down to 100, and the sum of 1 to 100 is the same all the time, however much anybody tried to change their position within the ranking. So all the effort which people were making and the sacrifices that people were making at the level of society in giving up this leisure in order to increase their rank are producing nothing at the level of society. So this is the unproductive aspect of the zero-sum game that's involved in people trying to raise their status. And it seems to follow, doesn't it, that to stop this happening, what would we like to do if we could change their tastes? Well, we would like to make alpha as low as we possibly could, so that all they did, with the only leisure they sacrificed, was in order to finance consumption which they valued for its own sake. Now, what we want to do is to reduce games that people play against other people. But of course we want to motivate people by encouraging them to pit themselves against nature, to use their brains to the highest possible extent that they can, to develop their talents and produce as much as they can for the benefit of society as a whole. So I don't want to suggest that people shouldn't compare their performance with the performance of others. I think we should have benchmarking to show us what we can achieve, but we should question benchmarking where the only aim of the league table is to motivate people through the quest for rank. For this condemns as many to fail as to succeed, which is not a good formula for raising human happiness. So here is the utility function which we should be promoting. We should try and downplay rank as far as possible as a motivator, and we should try and play up the social contribution that a person feels they're making as the good motivator, i.e. we try to knock out the game against others, which is zero sum, and we try to promote the game against nature, which is a positive sum that can go up and up forever. Well, let me round off this by trying to assess what's been going on in the last 20 years. And I would say, basically, alpha up and beta down. I think that's the way our society has gone. Increasing stress on getting ahead and on financial incentives as the way to motivate people. The whole aim in modern pay policy is to align pay and output as closely as possible. In other words, performance-related pay. Now, that is easy to implement and sensible when output is simple to measure, which it is for many mechanical tasks and for some individualistic ones in the financial sector. But it's much more difficult to align pay with output the more the task is multidimensional, long-term, and based on teamwork. And in these cases, people have to be evaluated by a relative rather than absolute standard, how they compare with their peers. So every time you have one of these exercises, you're focusing on comparative performance and getting everybody extremely interested in rank, which is not a good idea. There's also another problem with increasing financial incentives, which is that people who introduce them tend to assume that when external motives for performance are increased, other motives will just remain the same. But this isn't so. Richard Titmus pointed out here many years ago when he discussed the supply of blood. But I want to report two rather interesting studies, very different ones, that come to the same conclusion. Edward Deci, an American psychologist, gave puzzles to two groups of students. One group, he paid for each puzzle that they solved, and the other group he didn't pay. After the time was up, other puzzles were left in the room. Both groups were allowed to go on working while something was happening. And the unpaid group went on playing around with the puzzles, and the paid group didn't, because they'd done what they were paid for, and why be interested in the puzzles? And this, I think, is a very nice illustration of how external motivation can reduce internal motivation. Here's a second real-life case from Switzerland, where in 1993, two communities had been selected as potential sites for storing radioactive waste. And an economist, Bruno Frey, arranged a survey of most of the inhabitants of these communities and asked them two questions in this order. First, the question was, would you be willing to have the repository here? And they'd been given the analysis. 50% said yes. Then he asked the following question. If the national government offered you a certain amount of compensation, which was specified, would you be willing to have the repository here? And the second question, only 25% said yes. So as soon as you raised the financial reward, people began to wonder whether really they should have these repositories, which they previously thought it was their duty to have, and they became pretty doubtful about it as a proposition, what was in it for them. So I would like to raise the question. I suspect that over the last 20 years, British governments have made serious errors in their approach to the reform of the public services. They have stressed ever more the need to reward individual performance rather than providing an adequate level of pay generally and stressing the importance of the job and the promotion of professional norms and professional competence. I want to end this section on one other issue. As you remember, we're trying to explain from yesterday why happiness has not risen and why depression, alcoholism and crime have, which happened especially in the golden period of economic growth, 1950 to 1973. It's no good blaming economic growth in general, since in some earlier periods of economic growth, like 1840 to 1914, alcoholism and crime both fell. So we have to look for features which are new in the post-war world. And the most obvious transformation of our life in the post-war world has been television, which shows us how other people live with a completely new intimacy. So that where people once could only compare themselves with people around the corner, then they can now compare themselves with almost anyone in the world. And I think it would be astonishing if such comparisons were not unsettling. Television differs from previous modes of communication, not only in its intimacy, but of course, secondly, in the sheer volume of exposure. You probably know this, but the typical Briton watches television for 3.5 hours a day, 25 hours a week, over a lifetime, spending more time watching television than working, doing paid work. In most European countries, viewing is a bit lower, but it's above 2 hours a day in most countries. So it's not fanciful to suppose that television is making a difference to our lives. Now, most of the public discussion has focused on issues of violence and sex. And there is, of course, it's a very controversial area, though the bulk of the research, I think, tends to support the common sense view that if you see violence over and over again, it tends to legitimize it, and similarly with adultery. And also, of course, that TV raises material aspirations. Now, there are not that many very clear facts on this because it's difficult to have a controlled experiment. And the biggest controlled experiment was, of course, when it first came in. In the 1950s, television was introduced in the US in different states in different years, and the research estimated that in the year it arrived, it increased larceny by 5% by the time 50% of people had got television. But of course, that's just the very beginning of the story. You can't really tell what the drip, drip, drip effect could have been in the subsequent years. And it doesn't say very much about the effect of TV on happiness, where we really have to speculate more through indirect inference. I'm just going to give you some rather interesting psychological experiments. I'll go rather quickly with this. These are all to do with models. Models were shown to, pictures of models were shown to women by the researcher Kenrick. He evaluated their mood before and after seeing the models, the women's mood fell. what about the effect on men? He showed the pictures of models to men. Before and after this, he evaluated how the men felt about their wives. after seeing the models, the men felt worse about their wives. So there's a more general hypothesis that television is creating discontent by bombarding us with images of body shapes, riches and goods that we don't have, both through drama and advertisements. The most impressionable people are young people, of course, And it is striking that in Norway and Sweden, advertising directed at children under 12 is banned. I don't see why it shouldn't be here. And I don't even see why we shouldn't try and restrict advertising to actually informing us. Finally, while I'm on public economics, let me revert to the question of equality. As I mentioned, people like James Mead always insisted that utility was measurable and that it would have declining marginal utility, and that would mean that you would want to transfer income from rich to the poor. But they had no empirical evidence. But now we do. From Eurobarometer, from the World Value Survey, we can see that the marginal utility, even of relative income, diminishes sharply. And comparing countries, John Helliwell has shown that the marginal utility of absolute income is also diminishing to more or less zero when you reach the level of the richer countries. So these are very powerful arguments for redistribution, both within and across countries. And of course they reinforce the case for taxation, because it's a good thing to spend the taxes on. Let me just very quickly make sure you know what I've said, and then I'll look forward to tomorrow. I've said, one, if I get richer, I get happier, especially in the short term. But two, it makes others less happy, and the effect fades in me. So corrective taxation is needed. We oughtn't to encourage income comparisons, nor the zero-sum struggle for rank. External incentives can undermine internal motivation. Advertising should be controlled, and we should redistribute. So let me set the scene for tomorrow, where I want to look at everything else which does affect happiness and the policy implications there. And this is how I think we need to think about it. We've got to maximize the sum of happiness given the way in which human beings function. Individual happiness depends on our genes, which I'll talk about in a sec, our previous experience and our current experience. Our experience depends again on genes, background, and then on national resources and the policies of the government, and so does our situation. So the real issue is, how can public policy be designed so that we choose those policies which, given our national resources and these various constraints of human nature, give the maximum of happiness? I think it's important to have some framework. That's the framework I have at the back of my mind. And I finally want to just get the genes out of the way, because many of you, I'm sure, have been saying, people have said to me, that aren't you just born happy or not? And of course it's true. We know that from comparing siblings, people are born different, and some may be born more predisposed to happiness than others, though of course then experience plays an enormous part in developing us. So our happiness depends on our genes and on our experience, past and present. And of course the reformer has to be interested in things we can change, which is the experience. But we'll never get this right unless we understand the full model here, how happiness is generated, which includes understanding the role of the genes. So let me end with this rather striking finding. This is the best of the twin studies, the Minnesota study of middle-aged twins. And for each pair of twins, the researcher knew whether they were identical or non-identical, and whether they were separated at or very soon after birth for the whole of their childhood, or whether they were raised together. And the striking point, of course, is the pattern of correlations of well-being. Now, well-being is measured using the multidimensional personality questionnaire, MPQ, and within each of these groups, for example, identical twins raised together, the researcher correlates the well-being of one twin with the well-being of the other twin. And you can see that for the identical twins, the well-being measured in middle age is very highly correlated, whether they were raised together or raised apart. And for the non-identical twins, there's very little correlation at all between their levels of welfare. So it's absolutely clear that there is a strong genetic element in a person's well-being. And I think it's very important that parents recognize this. And it's even more important, of course, when it comes to mental illness, where we also know that heredity plays a major role in schizophrenia and in serious depression, especially manic depression. And I think that the those analysts and others, like Ronnie Lang, I think is the most criminal, who have blamed the behavior of parents for almost everything that goes wrong with their children, have enormously added to the unhappiness of life in the post-war world. But having said that, I want to make an extremely basic point about genes, which is that, of course, the fact that if you look at the variation of happiness across people, a substantial fraction can be attributed to the genes, that doesn't tell you very much at all about what you could do to the average level of happiness in the population. Because if a better environment made everybody happier, the level of heritability, all these correlations, might well remain just as high as before, but everybody would have become much happier. And I think one should think of happiness a bit like height. Height is immensely heritable, but the average height of the population has risen by many inches in the last century. So there's absolutely nothing to stop us raising the average happiness of the population just because there's a heritable factor. I believe we can raise the happiness of our people, which is what I want to talk about next time. I shall end, having told you how to do that, I shall end with a rousing defense of the view that increasing the happiness of people is the most important thing to do. Thank you.
Richard, would you like to stay there and answer questions? Well, I'd like to thank Richard very much for that extremely stimulating lecture. And just to show how up-to-date he is, his final remarks were, in fact, picked up in an announcement on the morning news today about a new project where everybody's genes can, in theory, be catalogued and sort of hung around their necks, so we all know what genes we've got. But as the scientist announcing it said, okay, we may have a height gene, but look at how nutrition standards have gone up, so people have got taller, particularly so in Japan, I believe. But you're absolutely on the ball, on the leading edge of scientific as well as economic research. Now, let's have some questions. Would you say who you are, please? And wait for the mic.
Hello, it's Richard Bronk, LSE. I just wanted to ask you what you thought about the importance and implications of two other mechanisms linked to the ones you discuss, which may explain why income is not highly correlated with happiness, especially in rich countries. The first is the costs of economic growth, the offsetting impacts of congestion, pollution, and so on, which we increasingly have to spend money to offset. And secondly, the Fred Hirsch social limits to growth argument about why rivalry can increasingly happen in rich states, because once people have reached a certain subsistence level of welfare, increasingly they're interested in positional goods, having the houses in the nicest areas or golf club memberships or whatever, and then that brings in exactly the zero-sum game you're talking about.
I think that the environment has improved on the whole. in these countries that we're talking about, certainly for the last 25 years. So I don't think that that can be much of a factor. Positional goods, on the edge of the countryside affect a very few people. They're not very central features to my thinking in the general level of happiness. They're very much in the class of things that you get used to.
I think that one depends very much whose measurements you take. I mean, there are sort of green measurements of GDP per head and growth, which show that it's been more or less static for the last 25 years.
But all right, I'll give it static, but it's just no big deal.
And what about the Fred Hirsch point, positional goods?
Well, I say the most of the positional goods affect a very small number of people, and I think a lot of them are of the character that pale.
Okay. A question up there at the back, yes? Have we got a mic there?
Konstantin Bulic, Global Action Plan. Would it at all possible implement the changes that you suggested, especially the reform of the tax system, in the context of global capitalism, where the most kind of the locomotive of the economy of the US, where exactly opposite is largely happening, that is lowering of the taxes, widening gap between sort of executive pay and the rest of the population, conspicuous consumption of luxury goods and so on and so forth?
I think what's going on in the US is exactly the opposite of what I would recommend. But I would like to say, I'm not necessarily saying we should have higher taxes here. I'm saying that the taxes are doing something for us that most people hadn't realized.
Front row here. Can we have a mic up at the top along the front row?
Thank you. I'm Riccardo Puglisi from LSE. I want to make two points. Your concept of happiness is grounded on the idea of changes from time t to time t plus one, and also on differences between me and somebody else. But I think one dimension that is quite important is a dynamic one. In a sense, if I think about changes that can happen, I think about a situation in which I go on Kingsway and nothing happens to me, and another situation in which I go in Kingsway, I lose my wallet, and then I find it again.
You lose what?
My wallet.
Oh, right.
And I find it again. So, and the point is that the end point is the same, but I would like to know whether there's kind of pieces of evidence about which situation makes me better off, in terms of summation of my disappointment initially, and then my elation of having found the wallet again. And I think this is quite important. I think also this is important in terms of comparison between individuals, because in a sense you care about your relative position against somebody else, but I was thinking about what's going on with games. Basically, if a game is repeated, sometimes I can be the winner and sometimes can be a loser, but if the game is repeated and my chances of being the winner are not increased very much by the fact of being the winner in the first stage, then perhaps the elation of being a winner sometimes is more than disappointment of being the loser other times. And so, for example, this could be a reason for which people like to do games, because this is like a way in which you get all this stream of disappointments, but the elations of winning are bigger than the disappointment themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, I think these are very important questions that you're raising. I'm not sure I could comment on the wallet situation. but it's obvious if people's lives are boring, events can improve them, especially if they turn out all right at the end. but the question of the role of games against other people, I didn't have time to go into it as deeply, because obviously people do enjoy games against other people, and they also enjoy watching games in which people are pitted against each other. It's not that we want to take all the fun out of life because there are no games. We want to somehow separate those games which are basically life-enhancing, which I agree. You've got to win sometimes, but you can probably tolerate some losing so long as you're getting some winning. Separate those from the kind of games where probably it's typically the same people are losing time after time. It's rather fruitless.
Or suffering life-threatening injuries. I mean, boxing, for example, would be at one end of this spectrum, perhaps. The chap in the red jersey there. Can we have the mic, please, for the red jersey?
Sony Kapoor, ex-LSE. I'd just like to comment on what the gentleman upstairs said, and I think it's fairly compatible with what you were talking about in the sense. You said one of the important factors in happiness is our situation in the recent past. And in a sense, when I lose my wallet, I'm really, really annoyed. And the situation when I find it again, when I compare it with the recent situation in my recent past, I'm much better off than I was. Similarly, when there's a boom in the bust cycle and people's income goes down, and then it suddenly grows again, then I'm relatively much better off than I was in the recent past. And hence, that consequently induces path dependence, and maybe I'm happier because of that.
Well, I think when you come to boom and bust, I think that that's immensely undesirable, and I'll say something about that tomorrow. That there's a huge desire for security at that level. Desire for secure jobs, secure incomes. So I don't think we want too much excitement in that department.
Adair Turner is next. Mike.
Richard, I wonder whether you were a bit too dismissive of the positional goods argument, because I've been sitting here thinking about what you said, and I was struck in your first lecture, you pointed out that one of the things that people least like doing is commuting. Now, the extent to which you have to commute can, to a degree, be the product of whether you are high enough in relative ranking to afford the house close to your work where you don't need to commute. Mm-hmm. People also don't like crime, but your ability to live in the areas which have lower crime rates rather than higher crime rates is to a degree driven by your relative rank income, not your absolute income. So it strikes me that as you look at housing, there are a whole load of ways in which, and I think it doesn't change your model, but it complicates it, because there are some of the things which in your function of leisure and valued consumption, and then rank at the end, there are some areas of logically valued consumption, the desire to live in a place where you don't have to commute very long, or the desire to live in a low crime area, which are dependent on rank. And it complicates the model, but I don't think it changes the conclusion.
No, I'm not saying there are no positional goods. All I'm saying is that they just stay there all the time. I mean, the amount of land within 2 miles of City of London never changes, so it's difficult to see how that can be a source of a trend of any kind. Of course, crime is immensely important, and the rise in crime is, I think, the most incontrovertible index of the failure of our civilization to achieve all its objectives. But that's affecting everybody. I mean, you can maybe some people can avoid it by moving it on to somebody else, but if we look at society as a whole, it's the aggregate amount of crime is affecting the aggregate people.
A question here at the back, the lady.
Yeah, I'm from China, a journalist, so I noticed people do compare happiness coming from feeling better than the others, and the $50 and $100 thing, the two. It reminds me that China has embarked on the reform, and actually 20 years ago it was under a planning economy, and now it's marketizing everything. Capitalism started actually, but maybe my government would not say so, but I'm still saying that. But this the above pattern represents the old planning economy, you know, where people are getting less income, but they're feeling better. And now, you know, the rich are richer and the poor are poorer. So people, because of a compare, and then they have comparatively speaking, they are less happier. So is it, does it mean that socialism sometimes, in some respect, works better than capitalism? And also because social, I am experiencing the two different systems myself because I grow up in this area. And I all know the evils, you know, the comparison. I belong to above middle class. But still, you know, because we are not comparing with my peers. We are comparing with United States. And we are comparing with UK. You know, some people suggest me to give up my very good position back home and come here to work as a laborer. And they said because UK is a better country. So it drives everybody crazy, you know. You lose happiness completely, no matter you are in a relatively better situation back in China. Or everybody's not happy. No matter, I don't know how to explain this.
Well, I think you actually gave an example along these lines from East Germany. People were actually happier in a communist state than a capitalist one.
I'm thinking always between capitalism and socialism, which have both advantages and make people happy and also encourage creativity.
Madam, because our system is called the third way, and it's alive. It's alive and living in the LSE. Right, Richard. Now, please, can we have an answer?
Well, it's a very, very deep and difficult question. I don't know how miserable people were in China under communism, but I know how miserable they were in the Soviet Empire. And I would have some idea about how they might have been under communism, though you're quite right that for some people, in some situations, non-intellectuals, it gave certain stability and parameters and so on. And we know, and we talked about it a bit last time, actually, that it's very awkward for people when there are no parameters around which to build their lives, when everything becomes excessively fluid. It can become very, very unsettling. And I think that's one of the problems of very, very rapid economic growth. And another is the one you mentioned, inequality. Where, as I mentioned to you, the marginal gain to the rich people who become richer relatively is much smaller than the marginal loss to the poor people who become poorer relatively, so that the inequality is reducing the average happiness. So these are difficult elements to control as you try to move towards a freer and more prosperous system.
Good. Now, I have one question here and then another one there. We'll take this one first, please.
Robert Taylor, LSE. Richard, there are two points I'd like to make. One is that I've been working on some data, ESRC Future Work Employee Survey data, over the last 10 years. And what is clear is there's increasing dissatisfaction about the nature of work. And you may be coming to this in your lecture tomorrow, but I think I'd like to raise it now, because it seems to me I'll be more specific. In Britain, the growing dissatisfaction is because of the increasing hours of work, of paid work that people are being required to do, and in particular, women in lower incomes, with lower incomes and with family responsibilities. Mm. There's clearly been a substantial shift and change, which is significant and which does have a direct bearing on levels of happiness and satisfaction. Mm. But having said that, I've also been looking at some research and mass observation during the Second World War. And the point the Chinese lady made, borne up by this, despite the terrible adversity of the Blitz and all of the followed from that, actually the happiness indicators, mass observation found, were remarkably strong. In other words, the sense of solidarity, the rationing and the other measures that were taken to ensure there was a degree of equity pursued by public policy, mm. did have an effect on maintaining people's levels of happiness, irrespective of their materialistic condition, material conditions. It may well be, perhaps, I hope not, that the Evening Standard this evening is talking about a possible terrorist attack on London. I'm not suggesting that's the way of increasing our happiness in the capital, but nonetheless, the sense of the equity, the sense of being together, might have a bigger impact on levels of happiness than, you might say, market forces.
Yeah.
Thank you. I can't resist pointing out that it was Lord Robbins, when he was working in the economic section of the War Cabinet, who perfected the rationing system, which made everybody so happy, partly because they had points which they were free to spend on a wide range of different goods, but a limited number.
Now, I will say about work tomorrow, but of course the other classic instance is the electricity failure in New York, when everybody started talking to everybody.
Yeah. Well, a bit more than that, I think. Yeah, question here.
John Hopcraft, LSE. Richard, a couple of puzzles that have been occurring to me as you've talked. Firstly, you mentioned crime. You've trailed divorce, which I know you're going to talk about tomorrow. We've seen growing inequality in many societies. Although maybe the average level of happiness hasn't gone up, why hasn't the variance increased? Why don't we see a lot more people seriously unhappy with those kinds of changes you've been describing? And then my other question relates to your twins analysis that you presented. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that we need to pay close attention to genetic underpinnings of behavior and attitudes and so on. But the results you presented there don't seem to me to fit with any genetic model that I know of, because there was essentially no relationship for the non-identical twins, and yet a strong correlation for the identical twins. Mm. And if it was a straight additive model, you'd expect about half the correlation.
Sure. Yeah.
If it was a dominant model, about a quarter of the correlation. Yeah. And so I just wonder whether really those results are as secure as you suggest.
Well, on that last point, I forget the word that they used to describe a model which involves complementarity, but the authors of this are strongly critical of additive and dominant models when you're discussing things like well-being and personality, and strongly in favor of models of complementarity between genes. On the question of why the variance has not increased, I think a lot of the negative factors are affecting the broad range of society, aren't they? You may know more about this than I do, but family breakup has probably grown at a similar rate in most sections of society. Crime is probably grown in its impact proportionately on different sections of society by a similar amount. I don't know, but of course there are pockets where there's sort of shootouts going on, I know, which are very, very extreme cases, but I think it's an interesting question. Of course, behind that variance, there's the big genetic bit which is not going to shift anyway. So to get the environmental bits to produce very clearly established changes in the distribution is going to take big samples and probably more evidence than has come along so far.
We had a question in the front row up here. I think it was you. This mic is a positional good. Only one person can use it at once. So which of you? I think you were first.
He raised his hand as well, but, well. I wanted to ask about implications of these studies and these results to development, like especially if you think about non-industrialized countries and this kind of thing,
right,
because from what I understand, well, two results I've seen here. First, higher income doesn't bring necessarily more happiness. Second result, if there's a lot of change in a society, as inevitably there is if a country is developing rapidly, people will become unhappy because their reference group will change, they'll have access to more means of communication, more information. All these things are linked to development. So in a way, this turns upside down the idea that we have, that giving people more information, more options, increasing their living standards is what should be sought for. So how does this fit together? Or does it fit together?
Well, I think these are very, very important questions, and I'm not sure that I'm the expert on the countries you're talking about, but it seems to me that, I mean, one of the most obvious failures is that as people are redeployed physically, new communities don't come into being that replace the communities that people left. So it seems to me planning. Town planning is extremely, and the built environment extremely central to trying to produce the kind of ways of life which can replace some of the security and human contact which was lost by the movement of people. Movement is a very, very problematic thing, which I'll talk about tomorrow.
I think this would better be the last question up there at the back, if we could get the mic over there, please. Sorry, he was first. Yeah. Well, no, the mic, it's nearly there, it's nearly there. right.
Thank you. Michael Gilbert, LSE, retired. I'm reminded of my ancient studies on consumer theory with indifference curves and plane geometry when work was considered
to be... Can you speak up a bit? We can't quite hear.
When work was considered to be a bad and leisure a good. And I wonder, I couldn't see in your utility function any idea that there was happiness to be gained simply from the work itself, rather from the income it provided or the consumption which flowed from it. And the other very brief thing is that how does an army fit into that function? Its output is a little problematic and it all seems to be rank.
Well, work, of course, is incredibly important to a person's sense of identity and to their feeling of being needed, that society is wanting them to do something. And worklessness is a terrible thing, and I'll say something about that tomorrow. But of course, some of the elementary textbooks in economics are terrible because they give you the impression that, as you say, leisure is the good, and that people have no feeling about work. But you can always reformulate the basic textbooks. I'm now defending economics. to say that people care about leisure and they care about their work, but of course their work is directly related to the amount of leisure that they have. So you net, as it were, you're taking both those effects into account when you look at the impact of so-called leisure on happiness. You also take into account the fact of what the person feels about their work. People feel extremely strongly about their work, get a lot of pleasure from it, and an awful lot of people actually go to work in order to meet their friends more than even to earn a living.
Well, Richard, you're obviously enjoying this particular bit of work, so you're a proof of what you were just saying. But I wonder if I could just conclude with a question from the chair. It seems to be a lot of what's been said today seems to point to a connection between equality in society and happiness, inequality and unhappiness. Has anybody ever simply tried regressing happiness measures on the Gini coefficient?
Yes, and need to say sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but in the best study which I'll report tomorrow by John Helliwell, it doesn't show up.
Right.
I'm not saying that there isn't some effect.
It's an open question.
But it doesn't show up independently of the position of the individual in the income distribution. There's no sort of climatic, miasmic effect of it.
Right.
But it works through the ordinary diminishing marginal utility of income, as I said.
Yeah. Good. Well, thank you very much, Richard, and I'm sure you've stimulated us all, and we shall look forward to hearing the conclusion tomorrow. Thank you.